Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, April 18th, 2010, and this is show number 256. I'd like to give a little shout-out to everybody who's stuck in Europe and can't move around the country or get out of the country. We've got, I know Bart is hoping to get to Belgium to see his mom this weekend, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen. And our dear friend Dean is stuck in England. I guess that's not the worst place to be stuck, since he was supposed to have to go to New Jersey. So I don't know. I'm having trouble working up a little sympathy for him. But I know it's been a lot of trouble for a lot of people. So what are you going to do when you got a volcano? I guess that's the act of God. Yes, sir. We'll do what we got to do and live through it. Well, it's going to be a sad week for Steve and I. You see, we have the same birthday. That's not the sad part. We were born April 20th, 1958, just 4 hours apart. Some would say this should be disastrous. Two Tauruses together? How could that ever work? They're the bull. They're argumentative. They're, you know, closed-minded. They fight. Yeah, we do, but we still like each other. Luckily, it's more like destiny for us because we get along famously. In fact, we have celebrated our birthdays together for 30 years, starting with our 21st birthday when we weren't even dating yet. We were just really good friends at the time. It was a blast. So imagine my dismay when I was asked to speak at a prestigious conference for my company in Dallas on my birthday, our birthday. Yes, Steve and I will be apart on Tuesday for the first time in 31 years. We won't be together on our birthdays. I guess we'll survive, but it's going to be weird. Well, on a happier note, if you're an audio-only subscriber, you might not have noticed that over on podfeet.com, there's a video posted of a presentation we did to the Southern California Mac Owners / Users Group, affectionately known as SMOG. I like that name. It's a good name for a place in LA, right? Well, Steve and I went down there a few weeks back, and we had a great time. Devin was the one who talked me into it, and I'm so glad he did because it was an absolute blast. I taught them all about Skype and iChat and debated the virtues of each application for ease of use, cost, recording, and screen sharing capabilities. The SMOG folks were so gracious, they even laughed at all my jokes. You should go watch the video when you get a chance and see for yourself. A few weeks ago, we had Gene McDonald of Smile on My Mac on the show, talking about the newest version of Text Expander. During that conversation, she let slip there's an application for Windows that might make Text Expander users who have to use Windows 2 very happy. She made it kind of secretive, not sure why, but that made it fun for me to be in the know after we got off the air, and she let me know where I could find the software. Let's back up just a teeny bit, just to tease you a little while longer, and bring everybody else up to speed. Text Expander is a glorious application that allows you to define snippets of words and then assign a short abbreviation to trigger them. Simple examples include things like your signature or a common phrase you put in an email, or just a few keys of your choosing, and you can plop all those words in quickly. I use it constantly. I'm absolutely addicted to it. Now, I'm only telling you about the very simplest features of Text Expander. You can get really advanced with it, like using the built-in HTML library that Gene created that lets you leave your cursor between characters so it's ready for you to enter data in the HTML string and all kinds of crazy stuff. Anyway, Text Expander is so wonderful, but it's incredibly frustrating for me to go to work and have to use Windows and not have this delightful tool. It drives me personally batty. I've said before that I don't even hate Windows 7 anymore, but it feels so inefficient to type everything out over and over again, like my signature or anything like that, when I know if I were on a Mac, I'd be text expandering away. Well, the tease is over. The lovely folks over at 16software.com have created an application called Brevy for Windows. That's B-R-E-E-V-Y. Oh, and 16software is 16software.com. I was in love with Brevy the minute I installed it. Brevy opens with a bunch of pre-installed snippets, like accented words. No, never again do you have to search for how to put the accent on the E in cafe on Windows anymore. It also comes with autocorrects and HTML snippets. Out of the box, Brevy was totally useful. But as a Mac user who lives on Text Expander snippets, the real joy begins when you pull down on the file menu and you see the most beautiful words, Import Text Expander Snippets. It's nirvana for us. I have to tell you that I had my doubts that this would actually work, but sure enough, instantly. There's my snippets for Dumb Question Corner, Audio Hijack Pro, my signature line. Even the folders I created in Text Expander were available to me in Breevy. There was my podcaster folder and my Honda Bob folder. Everything. It was perfect. On the 16software.com website, they describe some of the uses for Text Expanding program that I hadn't thought about. They include over 13,500 abbreviations for medical transcriptionists. Now, that's a field I know nothing about, but can you imagine what a pain it is, the things they have to type? So I'm guessing Breevy would be a dream for them. They mention also that if you suffer from RSI, or repetitive stress injury, using a text-expanding program like Breevy could be a godsend. You have to stress your brain a little bit to remember the abbreviations at first, but soon you'll cut down on your typing and that will relieve your hands and arms. And finally, one for the rest of us, chronic misspellers. Now, I personally actually can spell pretty well, but for some reason my typing's gotten really lazy and Breevy just kind of cleans up for me along the way with 6,500 auto-correct entries. Remember, if you have a particular misspelling of your very own, something unique that you happen to do, you can always make it into an abbreviation in Breevy. Mine, personally, is typing manger instead of manager when I'm at work on the PC. Turns out manger, while it is a real word, just doesn't come up that often at work. So I'm going to set Breevy to fix it for me and always change it into manager. Now that I have you clearly hooked, let's explore a little bit how Breevy works. Not as a text expander clone, but a great application in its own right. Across the top, you see icons to make a new folder, edit a folder, or delete a folder. And right there, you can also create a new abbreviation or delete abbreviations. Folders are a great way to sort your abbreviations when you start to get giant piles of them. One new thing I hadn't seen before, but Jean will probably correct me and tell me that it's already in Text Expander because everything I've ever said, why don't you do this? She's gone, yeah, it's right here. But I don't know for sure. Anyway, what Breevy has is a new launcher button. That launcher allows you to create an abbreviation to launch a website right from a keystroke. You can even set up abbreviations to open folders and documents on your PC. That's going to come in really handy because I got to tell you, sometimes it's a little hard to navigate in Windows. One thing I like about Breevy is that they repeat the menus across the top and bottom of the window, which is kind of an unusual style, but it really works in the menus the way they've done it. There are 5 tabs of preferences for Breevy, and I will not go through all of them because there's like 28 different controls inside each one of them, but I did want to give you a few of the highlights. The most important one you want to note is if you are a Text Expander user, you want to enable Text Expander mode in the General tab. This will allow Breevy to behave more like Text Expander. On that same tab, you also probably want to click the Start Breevy with Windows checkbox, otherwise it's not quite as useful. Like I said, there's tons of options, and I'm pretty much, you know, too lazy to figure out what they all do for you, so go figure it out yourself. If you use multiple PCs or PCs and Macs running Text Expander, you'll want to check out their Dropbox Sync support. I put a link in the show notes to the 16software.com website where they have a step-by-step instruction set on how to keep your Text Expander and Breevy abbreviations in sync so you don't have to do any work to always have them at your fingertips. I love that 16 Software and Smile on My Mac have joined forces here to make us 2 great applications that help sliders like us to work efficiently. Check out Breevy from 16software.com for the free 30-day trial, but I'm pretty darn sure you'll go for the $30 purchase when your trial runs out.
G'day, girls and boys. Alley Cat, I've got a bone to pick with you. I had conquered my addiction to Boomshine, and then you just had to say how good it looked on your iPad, didn't you? Any idea how many days I was late leaving work because I'd spent way too long on my breaks playing, obsessively, Boomshine? Thanks, mate. Now, for those of you who don't know, Boomshine presents with 12 levels. Each level has a certain amount of little coloured dots floating around the screen. Touch one and it explodes. Each little dot touching it then explodes in turn. Once the required number of little dots explode, you move to the next level. Now, each explosion is accompanied by a musical note. It is a strangely pleasant and addictive game to play. But I got to wondering, are the sounds random, or does each colour have a set sound? As in, does every green dot explode with the same musical note? Etc. Now, I'm no audiophile, and I can't decide. and we all know you're not into music. So I thought I'd ask my darling Stevie P, your darling Steve, to investigate this for me. Does each colour have its own sound? Love you long time.
Well, Rose, you've done a bad, bad thing. I guess it's payback because I got you addicted to Boomshine, but of course I had to show Boomtime to Stevie P so he could tell us whether the colors make a specific sound. By the way, he says they don't. It's random. But now he's addicted to Boomshine too. Worse yet, our friend Ron was over on Friday night and Steve started pushing Boomshine on him. I felt like we were in that episode of Star Trek Next Generation when they get that game from Risa and everyone's addicted and pushing it on each other. Keep looking over my shoulder to see if a Qatarian agent is watching me. Well, if you'd like to play Boomshine through a web browser or get the download for iPhone and iPod Touch, go to k2xl.com. Try it. You'll like it, really. A couple of years ago, I made a video screencast at work of a really complicated procedure. It was like 45 minutes long. Well, this year, the people I did it for asked me to update it to show how to do the same thing on Vista because I'd done it on XP. Of course, since it was a video, it's impossible to update. I would have had to start completely from scratch. I know, people love video, but it's so time-consuming. I needed a better way to future-proof these instructions. And of course, I pulled out my trusty ScreenStep software. I relearned how to do all the work, took screenshots along the way. At the end of each step, at the end of each set of steps, I annotated the images, pointing at buttons and checkboxes with arrows and boxes, adding sequence numbers if the order they did things was important, and then I added text to explain why they needed to do each step. When I was done, it was still long, but it was gathered into nice packaged lessons, and then all of the lessons were gathered into a complete manual. I pushed the export to PDF button and emailed it off to my customer to have them review it while I'm in Dallas, and when I return, they'll have edits, which will be trivial to fix. I won't do a video for anything this complicated ever again. I was able to make this full manual because I have the pro version of ScreenSteps, by the way, which will run you $80. But if you use my coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, you'll get 25% off of that price, so it's only $60. If that's still too rich for your blood, or you don't need full-on manuals, you can go for the regular version for $40, and you still get to take 25% off of that price with my coupon. Get on over to ScreenSteps.com and check it out.
Hey, Allison. It's Donald from A Talkin' No Podcast, here with a review of the iPhone, iPod Touch, and now iPad app Air Video. I'm sure we all have tons of video files scattered about our various hard drives and computers. Maybe it's stuff you downloaded off of iTunes. Maybe it's some video podcasts you subscribe to. Maybe you recorded TV or movies off your TiVo. Or ripped some DVDs that you own into video files. Maybe you downloaded some videos off of YouTube or some random website or something. Maybe your cousin sent a video that she took from her camera phone of their cat doing something funny. Or maybe you downloaded videos through certain other means. Not here to judge. Let your own moral compass be your guide. But we have all these video files scattered on our computers, and they're probably in like over 9,000 different video formats, most of which can't be played on an iPhone or iPod Touch without some form of transcoding, which is both hard to do and time-consuming, not to mention it lowers the quality of the video. Also, I mean, let's face it, our iPhones are not infinite in storage. Maybe you have an 8-gig iPhone or a 16-gig iPad, you know, you bought the cheapest iPad. So you don't have a lot of room to store all your video files on it. Well, Air Video is a program that's here to solve those problems. It actually consists of two programs, an iPhone app, which works on both the iPhone, iPod Touch, and now iPad, and a little server program available for both Mac and Windows that you put on any of your machines that has video files stored on it. The server program is a small little program that sort of sits in the background and waits for connections to it from the iPhone app. So you run this iPhone app, and it looks on your network and brings up a list of all of the machines that it finds with a little server program running on it. Clicking through to one of them lets you browse the hard drives of that machine, and any video files that it finds, it'll let you play them. So in other words, it'll let you stream your video files over the network, so you don't have to load all of your video files in your iPhone or iPod if you want to play them. But here's the kicker. Let's say you want to play a file that's not in a format that the iPhone can play natively. Well, instead of you having to go to that Mac, run a transcoding program, and do all sorts of video voodoo to get it to work properly, the Air Video program will automatically transcode the video file on the fly. In other words, it'll start transcoding and playing the file right away. You don't have to wait for the whole file to finish transcoding before you can play it. I don't know what sort of voodoo they're using to do this, but it works amazingly well. I've thrown just about every oddball video file format I have at the thing, and it just works. And the quality is really amazingly quite good. I don't really see any noticeable degradation in quality versus the original version of the video. Another thing that it does that really impresses me is it supports subtitles. So if you're a foreign film buff, you'll really appreciate this. In my case, because of Otaku no Podcast, I watch a lot of Japanese anime. But I can't speak or understand a word of Japanese. I want to learn eventually, but I just haven't had the time. Well, fortunately, there's various groups of people out on the internet that actually take the Japanese anime, translate it, and make subtitles available in a standard format. And the Air Video program supports this standard format called SRT, and it works perfectly. So if you've got a lot of video that you want to watch on your iPhone or iPod Touch, but don't have enough room to load it all on there, or if your video files are in weird, obscure formats you don't want to spend all night transcoding, then Air Video is the right tool for the job. The server software, which is free, is compatible with both Mac and Windows, and the iPhone app works on the iPhone, iPod Touch, and now the iPad. And ooh, it looks beautiful on the iPad screen. And at only $2.99 is an absolute steal. They also have a free version with some limited features, but really, $2.99, come on, it's worth every penny. Check out the links that I'm sure Allison will post in the show notes for more information. Hope you enjoyed the review, and see you next time.
Donald, this is too cool. I bought it while I was listening to your review, loaded it on my MacBook Pro right here, and used screen sharing to put it on my Mac Mini media server. I can't believe how well this thing works. I was able to play a bunch of random content in a super cool interface that was so intuitive to use. I mean, right there were my two servers waiting for me when I needed them, clicked on them, and asked. All I had to do was add folders of where it was the videos were. It was perfect. Really liked it. One thing I think it can't do, though, is play video_TS files, which is really a shame because we have all of our home movie DVDs on our Mac Mini, so we can see the video TS files, and I tried to attach to those, but it didn't seem to do that. That was something I was really hoping I could do. Oh well, it's about time we bite the bullet and transcode them again to MP4s, but we've been too lazy to do it up until now. Maybe Air Video will give us the push we need to just get started on that activity. Realize these movies started as VHS tapes. Actually, they were mini VHS, VHS-C tapes that got moved onto VHS tapes and put into order and everything, and Steve labeled them and everything. And then they made them all into DVDs, but then Bart explained to us that the DVDs are probably going to start going bad, and he was right. They were starting to go bad. Several of them are unrepairable at this point. So we took those, and we made disk images onto our Mac Mini, and then we realized, well, wait a minute, disk images are not that convenient. You got to double-click and open them. So now they're all in the as though they were opened DVDs right now, which means we have to transcode them again. Well, Mark Shepard in the chat room is suggesting we do a batch encode with Handbrake. Now, I did not know you could do a batch encode. That might be enough, because we can just let that Mac Mini run all night long. We don't care. I thought I'd have to do them one at a time. Good news. Well, in any case, you can find Donald Burr of Otaku No Podcast at otakunopodcast.com, and Air Video is available from inmethod.com. I've got Robert Lachman of PhotographyInTheMac.com on the horn here today because he's doing some amazing work with his photos from his iPhone, and I'm fascinated by how these things look, and I want to know how he does it. Robert, how are you doing today?
Just fine, Allison. How are you?
I'm doing great. Well, I've been looking at these pictures, and I know they say give somebody the best piano in the world doesn't make them, Mozart or anything like that. So I don't ever expect to be able to photograph like you. But still, you're doing some, I mean, your iPhone photos at photographyinthemac.com are stunning. What are you doing? How are you doing these cool pictures?
Well, really, there's two different ways. One is by using apps that are made for the iPhone, like Hipstamatic, which is a very cool app. It makes your, we'll talk about it, and it makes your photos very arty. It almost makes it too easy to shoot really cool-looking photos. I don't know. It's taking my business away, I guess. And the other way is to shoot just the regular camera, and then I do a little work in Photoshop with maybe some plugins and really jazzing them up a little bit.
Okay. So talk about this Hipstamatic thing. I saw you said something about having a lens on your camera, and I don't understand how you put a lens on an iPhone.
If you look on the iTunes chart of what are the most popular camera apps, coming in number three is one called Hipstamatic. It's one you have to pay for. It's $1.99, and it's very cool. It almost makes your photos look like art. You can do things black and white, color, but it gives them that old, really old school look, like you're using an old plastic camera, and you can completely vary things. And it's cool because you actually can change the lenses to give different looks, and you can change the film. So it's a very cool way to go.
But again, this is still, we're talking about an iPhone.
That is correct.
Wow.
And what's different with this app is you actually have to kind of decide ahead of time like which lens and which film you're going to use, and when you shoot the picture, that's what you get. This is not one of those apps that you can bring photos into.
Okay.
A lot of the apps that you can do stuff, you can shoot the pictures with the app, and you can bring your library of photos into it, and then you can do stuff to it then. This one you can't. It's sort of decide ahead of time, pick your style of film you want to use, pick your style of lens you want to use. And it's fun to do the lenses. By changing lenses, you're not really changing lenses. You're flipping through with your finger to different styles of old school lenses. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, that looks really cool. I'm looking at it right now, and of course, I just bought it on iTunes. For spelling, by the way, you guys, it's Hipstamaticapp. So you haven't got a chance to, that's HipstamaticApp.com. So Hipstamatic is the name of the app. So how do you, so what are the different lenses that make sense to you that are doing some of these cool effects? Like you've got this one of the Angels Flight Railway ticket office with, it's got a kind of a spooky black border and it's in black and white. Looks kind of neat. How'd you do that one?
Okay, that one, I think it's an additional film you have to buy. There's about three or four different kinds of film you can actually buy for your camera. And this is how they make a little bit extra money, which isn't really bad. They only charge 99 cents for each different kind of film. And a couple extra lenses, I believe. I haven't bought any for a while. But so maybe you're going to spend another $4 to kind of get your camera all ready to go with everything they have. But, you know, that's part of the fun. And it's just so much fun. So the one I use, which is probably my favorite setup, which I hate to give the secret away because it just, you just shoot cool photos at portraits. You can just do, have a lot of fun. And the lens I use is called John S. And the film is called Black Keys, Black and White. And that's my favorite combination. It puts kind of a dark black border around your film. And it gives you this very cool hint of the color. It's not completely black and white. It just gives you this cool little touch of the color, which is a lot of fun. If you don't like that cool touch of color, you can always open the photo up in Photoshop and then knock out the color completely by, you know, going to a black and white mode out of your, instead of doing color.
You know, it's funny. Until you said that, I hadn't noticed it, but like you've got a picture of the Best Buy sign and everything looks like it's black and white, but the Best Buy sign is just this very faint, faint pale yellow.
It's very cool. It's so arty, and it just sort of like you get that hint. Like you don't notice the color unless you really look.
Yeah, yeah. Now I'm looking at them, and it's definitely not black and white. I did not notice that. How interesting.
Yeah, it just, I can't explain. And they just came out with a newer version. Their newest version is the 150. And what's nice about it, they upped the quality of the photos. And that's, to me, most people don't realize it, but I bring all my photos usually into Photoshop, even these, just to maybe burn down the edges a little bit, do a little bit of tweaking. And you want the size of your image to be big. A lot of the programs you get for your to put on nice borders and do some cool things, they reduce the size of the image. So that's one of the things I look for. I only like working with programs that keep the photo in a large size, because if it's too small, you really can't do much with it. I mean, you can post it on the internet and things like that, but I still like the feeling of having a little bigger image to work with.
Yeah, you know, I didn't realize that at first. I thought the iPhone was just made really low-resolution photos, because I'd get these little bitty things if I put them on, you know, TwitPic or something like that, and then I'd bring them into my Mac through Aperture, and all of a sudden they're, hey, wait a minute, this is a, you know, decent-sized photo.
Yeah, I think you could make some nice 8x10s. Size-wise, if you wanted to make prints, you maybe squeeze it up to 11 by 14. Certainly, I'm not thinking you can't really go 16 by 20s. I've tried to make some bigger prints, and it kind of breaks up when you get too big.
Wow, but that's interesting. It can go that high. I would never have thought that. I think we get all hung up on this, well, it's got to be a 12-megapixel camera to be worth anything. But I have a 2-megapixel photo that my buddy Ron took. It'll now be 10 years ago on a one of the early Nikons. I think it was a Nikon 990, and it was a 2-megapixel photo. But I've got it as a 5x7. It is spectacular. There's no way you would think this wasn't film.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. People do get a little too involved with, you know, what size it is. But I think it's important at a certain point. You do need a certain size to make prints. It's a little different than a 72 DPI computer screen.
Yeah, definitely. So now you also, in addition to using Hipstamatic to take the photos in the first place, some of these you've done completely in Photoshop, right?
That is correct. But let me give you one more tip on the Hipstamatic before we go and move on from that one. This one does have some preferences, and that you set them under the system.
Oh.
You know, certain, and there's a couple ones that are important to look at when you do it. One is it gives you your camera frame, and I use the one that gives you the closer to what you see is what you get. It gives you two different options, and I use the one that it's a tighter view of what you see, and that way you're actually, it doesn't bring in a lot of the extra edges and stuff like that. You'll see when you try it. The other one, too, is you can change the file size, and I have it at the biggest.
Oh, okay. Okay. Oh, that's a really good tip.
Yeah, let me go to that real quick, because some people forget that our options are in different areas with the iPhone. It's kind of a funky deal, but...
You know, I never noticed that until I myself did not even know that was there until I was actually on the iPad, because the whole left side of the preferences shows in the iPad. It's a big, long string. And I was like, well, wait a minute. Why are there preferences for all these applications in here? So I've never, ever looked at that before. There's preferences for every single app, it looks like.
I don't know if it's weird, because some apps seem to have preps within themselves. So I'm not...
That's what I was used to.
Yeah, I don't know why the developers do it different ways, so I'm not sure how that works. The ones I use, though, is it's the viewfinder, and I do use the precision framing. Yeah, they also have classic, and that lets in a lot of extra, and I don't really like that as much. And then the other one is in the developing, I use the high quality print. Also, this camera is slow to operate, and so it's not something you're going to want to, if you're shooting a lot of photos and you want to do them quickly. It takes a while. The print actually processes. So
a little kid and a dog running in the park, not so much.
And no, I'd stay away from that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I played with it. Oh, I talked about this before we got on the air. I should tell the story. So I'm sitting at photographyinthemac.com looking at some of Robert's great photos, and I wrote on his blog, I said, you know, I don't understand how you take these amazing pictures. And what is that lens you keep talking about putting on there anyway? As soon as I hit send on that, my friend Ron, sitting on the couch because it's Friday night and that's what we do, and he leans over and goes, hey, Alison, I got to show you this really cool application I got for my iPhone. It's called Hipstamatic. And he starts showing it to me. I'm like, okay, you couldn't have done that 10 seconds before, so I wouldn't have put that dopey comment on Robert's blog. But it was fun.
That's okay. I don't get that many comments, so I love every one I get. So feel free to put on any you want.
Comment away, everybody.
Absolutely.
Okay, so good. We got some preferences. That's good to know on the Hipstamatic. Now, what about the ones like you've got this one of the Angel Flight's ticket office. It looks like it's been HDR'd or something. It's all cool looking.
Yeah, that is. It's a little hard to do. There is actually an HDR app for the iPhone that you can actually use. It's okay. I've tried it. I mean, it's not like doing true HDR in the terms of where you get these crazy looking great photos. It actually does kind of put the photos together. So it does what it says, but it's not like really doing real HDR in terms of what you're seeing out there today.
Okay.
So what I normally do is I use the normal app, the normal photo app, and I take my pictures. It is a lot faster. It works great. And the one thing you have to remember when you're shooting pictures, there's no real digital zoom. So you got to move to what you want to shoot. You know, it's
right.
I mean, there is digital zoom. There's no optical zoom. And that's the one downside to these kind of cameras. So you got to take the picture, get what you like, experiment around. And it's also very nice, too, because with the newer iPhone, you can actually lighten and darken a little as you shoot by touching on the screen.
Right, right.
Have you done that?
Yeah, and the 3GS, it has that. My first iPhone, it didn't. So, yeah, that's a neat feature.
That's a very good feature because you can really vary on how your exposure looks, and a lot of times that's very important. So that's probably the one thing I do. I kind of check to see, you know, is my exposure right? I may take a couple with a little darker and a little lighter because, you know, sometimes it looks better when you get back. When you get it into Photoshop, you may want to, one might work better for you. So usually I start with Photoshop, but I do use plugins. There's so many good ones available. The one I use the most is probably from Topaz Labs. They make about 5 different plugins. They have a great bundle. It's probably, I don't know the exact price, but I'd say it's probably in about the $150 range or under.
Okay.
And sometimes they have discounts, especially at shows and stuff. They usually have it a little cheaper. The one that makes that great looking HDR effect is called Topaz Adjust.
Ooh, I think I might have, that might be the one I own.
Yeah, you can really do some cool things. You just kind of ramp up all the sliders. They do have some presets. Start with the presets and see what you like, and then just start ramping up all the different sliders. And you can just, it does give that, I just shot 3 exposures of the same image with different exposures and put them all together.
But now you're on your iPhone. So did you tap, say, on the ticket office and once on the sky and once on the railing?
No.
Right,
this is all done with one photograph.
Oh, okay. So you're
not
combining.
It all with one photograph.
Oh, okay.
I also like the one is, there's a couple more I use a lot. And one is called Topaz Clean and the other is Simplifier. Those are my two just kind of, I love to try them. The Simplify kind of gives, you can use that to give photos maybe a little more of a painted look, which is very nice. And I usually hit it with that first, or I use Topaz Clean, which kind of gives it that almost like a cartoon effect. And then I give it a little of that, and then when I hit it with that Topaz Adjust, it gives it that second effect. So sometimes I'll hit them twice.
So Topaz Adjust doesn't have a specific thing about doing HDR photography, right?
That is correct. But if you were to go on their website and check them out, you do get that effect.
Yeah.
Get that effect.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, Bart did talk me into one of those. I think it's Adjust that I own.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I enjoy just the challenge of taking the photos and trying to make them look pretty nice. Yeah, I mean, if I was walking around with a DSLR and a tripod and, you know, you could do some much nicer HDR effects and those kinds of things with photos like that. But, you know, I always have my phone with me, and that's part of the fun of it.
Well, I think that is exactly what I said at the beginning was, you know, I think I just need a really good camera. I must need a $2,000 camera to take pictures as good as Robert. But here he's doing it with a crappy little iPhone camera and taking these amazing shots.
Well, let's not get too carried away because I used to be taking my pictures with my BlackBerry, which had a 2. So, you know, this is much nicer. I'm up to 3.2. So I'm like styling now. And I have all these controls and cool things you could do. I had to really rely on, you know, nice lighting. I mean, one of the things with this camera, and if you actually look at like that one photo I have up there, you can see on my website, if you go to it, it's kind of like a nice beam of light coming through. You know, it's one of those things where you do still have to use the lighting, the composition, and, you know, kind of the basics of photography. It you have to have a nice photo to start with most of the time, although with some of the plugins and stuff you can do, you don't have to have that nice a photo. So I tell you.
Well, yeah, I think the eye is something you either have or you don't. My daughter, Lindsay, just I'll walk around taking pictures with her. We have the same camera. We've both got the Nikon D40. We're walking around taking pictures, and I'll go back, and I have snapshots, you know, and she's got art. She just sees things that I don't see. So I'll never don't worry, I won't be any challenge to your photography business, that's for sure.
I don't know. You just have to change your attitude, because I think that's the most important thing to taking better pictures.
Really?
Yeah, you just have to. If you think your photos are good, you know, then they'll be better. Yeah. It's a sales job, part of it, you know, being if you think your stuff is cool, I think.
Well, that's great. Well, Robert, I appreciate you taking the time with us today to give us a little insight into what you're doing. And I'll have to start playing with that Hipstamatic. Maybe I'll be as cool as you when I get good at it.
You know, like I say, it almost makes it too easy to shoot really nice photos. I don't know if that's, it's just so much fun. And, you know, I enjoyed it. Just, it seems much more old school. And when you see some of the results, it's just a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. It's very, very cool. Well, the way I keep track of what Robert's done lately on his website, because I'm too lazy to actually go there and check every day or do one of them silly RSS readers, is I follow Robert on Twitter at Photo and Mac. So that's the best way for me to keep up with what he's doing. Thanks for joining us, Robert.
I appreciate it, Allison. You have a good weekend.
Well, that was a lot of fun talking to Robert. I love talking to him. He just knows so much stuff I don't know anything about. I do have to make a correction, though. I actually, when I went to such great care to spell Hipstamatic, I actually spelled it wrong. It's HIPSTAMATICAPP.com. It's in the show notes, so you don't have to do it, but I did need to make that little correction. I also put links to the tools he talked about from Topaz Labs at topazlabs.com, so you can find them afterwards. So remember I told you last week that I had a recall of a hose on my Acura, and I told you Honda Bob would try to convince me to get it done for free by the dealer instead of paying him to do it? Well, I was right. It's exactly what he did. Imagine having a mechanic who tries to save you money instead of trying to soak you for every penny he or she can get, whether you need that repair or not. I know, it's kind of mind-bending, isn't it? But that's what I get with Honda Bob. Along with the convenient in-home care, there's nothing better. I convinced him that I'd rather pay him than lose a half a day of my life going to the dealer. I had to be firm with him, though, because he kept arguing with me, but he finally agreed to let me pay him to do the job. If you live in the LA or Orange County areas, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, Honda Worldwide. It's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. How are you this lovely Saturday, Bart?
Well, it actually is a lovely Saturday. Do you remember last week I said I was wearing shorts?
Yes.
I haven't taken them off. Well, I've changed shorts, but I'm still wearing shorts. It has been amazing weather all week here.
Oh, nice. Even though you're under a volcanic ash cloud, or are you guys hit by that?
Oh, yes, we're hit by that. In theory, I was going to be saying to you, we may have to find someone else to be a Belgian for next weekend. But right now it's looking like I'll be right here in Ireland next weekend instead of in Belgium where I'm supposed to be.
Because everyone who's trying to leave, move around in Europe right now can't, so they're all going to be trying to do it next weekend probably?
Well, I was listening to the news on the radio at lunchtime, and the lady from the Met Office said that from what we can tell, the prevailing wind is going to stay the same until at least Friday.
Wow.
Which means if the volcano keeps spewing out stuff, as the geologists think it will, and the weather keeps the way it is, as the weather forecasters think it will, there is no one going to be flying in or out of Ireland until at least next Friday.
Oh, and I'm due
to leave on Thursday.
Oh, my gosh. You know, my our good friend Dean is stuck in England right now. He was supposed to be home on Friday to get back home to spend a weekend alone with Suzanne because their son Joe was out of town and finally going to get a weekend alone. And he said, we got a weekend alone, just not with each other.
Oh, nuts.
Yeah. So, gosh, if he's going to be stuck in England for a week.
Well, it may be different in England because Ireland was open for a long time after England was already closed. So there was a lot of flights to America got out of Ireland when they couldn't get out of England. But now it's hanging over us. And we're in the middle of a high pressure area. So it's just kind of sitting there now.
Yeah. Poor people. Well, luckily it's lovely weather there to be stuck there. So I guess maybe that's not the worst thing in the world.
Well, that's it. Yeah. It's certainly interesting.
There you go. Well, let's kick into Security Light now. For those who haven't listened before, Security Light is where Bart tells us about security things that we can actually do something about. And he's not allowed to make our eyes glaze over too much. Give us a good idea of what we should be watching out for this week, what kind of patches we ought to do, and what kind of icky things we shouldn't open. But he's not allowed to say no script at any point during the plot.
Oh, okay. Well, it's Patch Tuesday has been and gone. So all those Windows machines, be they virtual, be they netbooky, whatever they are, fire them up, let them update themselves, and put them back to sleep.
Alrighty.
Then Adobe seemed to have decided that Patch Tuesday is for them too. It's happened a couple of times now where they've kept their updates until Microsoft does one. So Adobe released an update also on Patch Tuesday, and it's a cross-platform one, so Windows, Linux, and Mac, and it's for our wonderful friends Reader and Acrobat.
Well, at least they're patching.
At least, yeah, exactly.
Patching's good.
Patching. They're not particularly clear on exactly what the story is with this one, but Adobe recommends this update for all users of Adobe Reader. So there you go.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, exactly. Best not to let that one dwell too long, considering PDFs are now 80% of successful hacks are being done through PDFs.
Wow.
Now, well, that's so what one company said from their data, which is a swap, because this time last year it was Flash.
Wow, yeah.
So it's been Adobe and Adobe. Poor guys.
Sounds good. Okay.
Then Apple did something that I consider to be very Microsofty. They updated their update.
Oh.
So we have 10.6.3 update version 1.1.
So if we did that, 12 gigabyte download before for 10.6.3, we have to do it again?
I don't think we have to do it all again. From what I gather, the update is smaller than the thing it's updating. So you won't get this update until you've done the 10.6.3.
Okay.
I think. It's a bit weird. Apple don't usually do updates to updates. That's a very Microsofty thing. But they did in this case. So 10.6.3 version 1.1 is out. And depending on when you ran your software update, you may have actually picked up the 1.1 version anyway. Because this came out on Tuesday.
Okay. I don't. I did the first one right away because that's what you told me to do, and I do as I'm told when you tell me, not when anybody else does. So I guess I got to go catch another update.
Yeah, just as I say, run software update and see what it finds. It's also going to find security update 2010.003 for Leopard and Snow Leopard. It's not a very big update. It patches a grand total of one bug, the pwn2own bug.
Oh. So they haven't been smart enough to do what he does, but they're smart enough to patch the one thing he did expose.
Yeah, the one he had to expose because that's the condition of winning the prize.
Okay.
So the other 19 are probably still there, but the one he had to expose to win his prize has been patched.
Okay.
And that's kind of it for Security Light. So basically,
I like it's it
a
when
whole
it's quiet.
Load of updates. Yeah, well, no one gets off. Mac people have to update, the Windows people have to update, and everyone just has to update their Adobe stuff.
Okay, sounds good.
So what I also wanted to do quickly is a little follow-on from last week. So last week we had our big discussion about one of the particular reasons Apple may have limited to having to use their Xcode tools. It's sort of a technical one. There are also other reasons, and there's been a couple of very good blog posts doing the rounds from people in the know. And I just linked to three of the particularly good ones in the show notes for people to read at their leisure. I don't think there's any point in us saying what's written there when people could just go read it. But I just wanted to mention these three, especially the first one, because according to reports, Jobs pointed people at it and went, this guy has the right idea.
Oh, that's cool.
Which is one hell of a bit of praise for John Gruber from Daring Fireball, because it was his post that Jobs pointed at.
I like how Leo referred to it. He mentioned the fact that Steve Jobs mentioned John Gruber's blog post, but what he said was, Steve Jobs said to go read this blogger's blog.
Yeah.
And he didn't say John Gruber. I mean, John Gruber's name holds a fair amount of weight. You know, he could have said John Gruber, but he said a blogger, you know.
Well, I guess in Steve's worldview.
No, this was what Leo said. Leo referred to it as a blogger.
Which is weird because John has been on Leo's show.
Right. In fact, he was on it, I think, like a week or two ago. So
yeah, recently, yeah.
Yeah, it was kind of, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of
now, the other people aren't as well known as John Gruber, but they also make well-reasoned and well-argued points.
So we should say their names, Ian Samuel and Steve Chaney.
Exactly.
Great.
So as I say, if people are interested, because I do think this topic caught a lot of people's attention and a lot of people sort of jumped on the Apple is evil bandwagon. But here are three well-written, well-argued pieces that may give you pause.
Okay. Good. All right. So now we get to have some fun. So can I give them the setup of how we got into this topic?
You have no idea what you've let yourself in for, by the way.
Uh-oh. So
you scratch the surface on something. It's like you scrape the top of a mushroom and suddenly you realize that it's actually interconnected to an entire forest-sized organism.
Oh, dear. Well, we always learn, right?
So exactly. So I'll let you set it up.
Let me see. I was hoping to scan real quick to see who the two people who were helping me. I think it was Alistair Jenks and, oh, shoot, it would be great if I could remember their name. Who the other person was. Maybe it'll come up my Twitter feed here. So I took a photograph of a rose next door. It was a kind of a rather pink and reddish rose, and it was just gorgeous. I brought it up in Aperture to see if I should do anything to intensify the colors, and it just looked amazing right out of the box. Mm. So I decided... Well,
it had little droplets of water on it. It really looked beautifully fresh and vibrant.
Yeah, it had just rained, which was odd all in itself. And
so you don't see that very often, do you? Water droplets.
Yeah, that was a really a strange reaction. A lot of people said, "Well, I don't understand. You know, how could you have rain on your roses?" So I called it raindrops on roses.
Do you guys ever have rainbows?
Actually, we did that very day. As I walked back from taking the picture of the rose, I saw a rainbow. So yeah, when it rains, we do. So.
But I presume they're very, like, they're a big deal if you see one, whereas we'd see, like, a couple, you know,
couple
one every month or so.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they do stand out a bit. So anyway, so this picture looked great. And I said, all right, you know what? I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to enhance at all. I did enhance the white one, by the way. I brought out the greens a little bit with brushes and Aperture and all that. I had a good time. So I uploaded it up to Flickr. And all of a sudden, the pink was real dull. It was significantly different than what I had seen on screen. So I took a screenshot of, I put Flickr to the left side of the screen, and I put my Aperture library to the right, so you could see them at the same time. So no matter what my, you know, I don't calibrate my monitor or anything like that, whatever, it was different, right? So I posted on it, and actually Steve Stanger wrote, and he said, I don't know what's wrong with your, but it looks fine on mine. When I look at it in Flickr, it looks very bright, vibrant. So he took the pictures and he compared them again. And so we went back and forth for a while and trying to, oh, good, I'm coming up on it. Let's see. It was Goatman, I think, was one of the people helping me here, along with Alistair and Steve Stanger. So we went back and forth trying to figure out, well, how could it possibly look right for Steve, when I realized he was looking at it in Safari and I was looking at it in Firefox. At this point, I think it was Goatman who said... Or it might have been Alistair. I keep getting confused. Anyway, yeah, it was Alistair. He said, probably Adobe RGB and Aperture, and by default, JPEGs will be sRGB. And I said, what? And he said, it's a whole area I know enough about to know. I don't know squat, but it breaks things. Might be a good chit-chat across the pond. I thought gray area was a nice little pun, but he was talking about color spaces. And I said, Bart, what's a color space?
Yeah, well, you have color spaces and color profiles, and the whole thing is kind of intermingled. So I wasn't... It took me a while to figure out exactly how we should attack all this. So I sort of figured that the logical flow through this conversation would be to start off and say that as you get more into photography, you're going to start to really do fine little tweaks to your photos, and you're going to want them to be perfect because you tweak them to be perfect and you share them. And then you get exactly the disappointment you run into where you went, but it was so shiny and now it isn't.
Right, right.
So everyone runs into this. I run into it. Everyone runs into it. It's particularly troublesome in browsers where you get a sort of a desaturated and a flat look to it.
Yeah.
And actually, there's also a second level of disturbance that you're going to hit at some stage, which I'm not sure you've run into yet. But when you get over the whole web thing, you're then going to notice that when you go to someone else's computer, the colors look wrong, too. They're probably going to be too warm or too cold compared to what you saw them as on your monitor.
But that's the color calibration of the monitor issue.
Yeah, so that's a slightly separate issue. So the whole thing really revolves around these things called ICC color profiles.
And ICC. There is, okay.
It's basically... Yeah, it's so hard to explain this stuff.
It's like I've asked you one question about physics, so you have to start at the beginning.
It kind of is. Now, I've stuck a link in the show notes to the full Wikipedia thing on ICC color profiles. If people want to get into the horrible maths of it, they can, but I don't want to do that.
Okay,
because
good.
That will make my brain explode, your brain explode, and make everyone else go to sleep. So we're not going to do that. But I guess the first thing you should think about your color profile is it's the color profile tells a computer or a camera or a scanner or a printer how to deal with color. And some web browsers, well, no, okay. Most web browsers completely and totally just ignore it. It's like, no, I'm going to ignore that ICC profile. It's in there in the JPEG, and now I'm just going to pretend it's not. And that means they don't render the color right. So, you know, Aperture has done its edits and then inserted the color profile into the image to tell any program that wants to display the image, when you go to display it, this is the color profile that you should be using.
So back me up for just a second here. I thought that like a JPEG said, this dot is this color. This next dot is this next color. Or it might say these five dots in a row are this color. What does the color profile say other than it's this color? Like, you know, here's the hex code for it or whatever. Why would it need any more than that?
Color isn't quite like that, though. For a start, the JPEG doesn't really quite just work with hex code. So JPEGs can store the color information in different ways. And the different ways of storing the color information give you different so-called color gamuts. And so Adobe RGB is one mathematical way of describing colors. So it's a way of turning hex values into actual colors. And regular sRGB is a different way of turning hex values into colors. So it's not like a bitmap. It's not that simple.
Okay.
So a JPEG, the JPEG format allows for multiple ways of describing color. And one way of describing color is Adobe RGB, which is Adobe's color palette. And a different way of describing color is sRGB. So it's a bit like a codec inside of an AVI.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So the JPEG format lets you say, here's a bunch of ones and zeros, and here's how I'm going to represent color within those ones and zeros.
Okay. All right. So there's no standard for that. It changes.
It's not quite that it changes. It's that the image... Okay, we need to take a step back to these ICC profile things.
Okay.
It's really the only way to go about it. The concept, ICC has two parts. They have this idealized, perfect way to represent color that they call the profile connection space, or PCS is what we're going to call it.
Okay.
But it's just a perfectly idealized way of representing color. It has 16 bits of color, so insane amounts of color, and it can represent pretty much any color with perfect detail. Now, you couldn't actually use PCS, or all of your files would be 20 squillion gigabytes big.
Okay.
But they define this perfect way of representing color. And then what an ICS profile is a list of translations to and from this perfect color space. So if you want a JPEG and you want to convert, say, a JPEG to a TIFF and you don't want to lose color information, you'd want an ICC profile to represent the color space in the JPEG and an ICC profile to represent the color space in the TIFF. And you go from the JPEG to the perfect one in memory and then from the perfect one to the other one. And then you have a conversion in theory with no loss of color.
Okay, my head hurts already.
I know. But the only thing you need to remember is that an ICC profile is a translation from one way of representing a picture to this idealized perfect color space. And then if you want to go from one to another, you need two color profiles, the color profile of your source and the color profile of your destination.
Okay. Okay. And the ICC.
It's a double translation.
And that's the ICC profile.
That's the ICC profile.
And that's embedded in the image when JPEG is created.
There's lots of places where it comes in. So anything that displays an image, takes an image, or stores an image can have an ICC profile.
Okay, so I'm kind of comfortable with your analogy to a codec. So anybody who didn't follow what he meant was in order to play a video file like an AVI, you need a coder to create that file, and you need a decoder to decode it so that you can play it. And that's the codec he was talking about. So someone can create it with a codec, but if you don't have the codec to open it, to display it, you can't play it. And that's why you get an AVI file that you can't play. So
okay, and then if you want to take the analogy further, you can. if you want to convert something from an AVI, from, let's say, H.264 inside an AVI file to, say, MPEG-2 inside an AVI file, to get from one to the other, you need to first go out to a totally uncompressed format and then go recompress it.
Okay.
So that's what this PCS is. It's a perfectly uncompressed equivalent. So you take your compressed H.264, uncompress it out to an uncompressed format, and then recompress it to JPEG.
Okay. Does a RAW file have an ICC profile?
It most certainly does. So, like I said, anything that takes a picture, renders a picture, or stores a picture can have an ICS profile. So the moment you press the shutter on your Nikon D40, the camera actually has its own color profile.
Okay.
Your monitor has a color profile, which is why it's so important if you're setting up, particularly on a Windows machine, because Macs just do this stuff automatically, but on a Windows machine, when you get that list of all those different monitors, if you just go for a generic monitor, your colors are never going to look right or never going to look perfect, because actually you should be genuinely choosing that it's a Dell and it's this model, because Windows has a copy of the ICC profile for all the different makes of monitor.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're using the wrong profile to display your images, they're not going to look right.
Okay.
So there's ICC profiles everywhere. So the way it works is you take a picture with your camera, it uses the camera's ICC profile to create a JPEG, and then that JPEG contains an ICC profile to describe what's in the JPEG, which is, depending on your make of camera, it's probably Adobe RGB. Then you load that into Aperture, where it will use the ICC profile of the JPEG in combination with the ICC profile of your monitor to let you see what the photo really looks like.
Oh, my God.
Okay, you see, everything has
to just keep going. I'm going to go get some aspirin right now.
I warned you that this was a hornet's nest that you scratched at.
Okay. So, but that all just works.
It all just works until someone in the chain decides to ignore what's in the ICC profile.
Ah.
Which is what
this is where Firefox
some web browsers
do.
Internet Explorer does it. Firefox does it. I think Opera does it. I'm not sure because I never use it. But if you look at browsers in terms of market share, the majority of web browsers that people use every day ignore color space information, which means your pictures look wrong. Now, why would they do such a thing? Well, the answer is they do it because web developers do silly things. It's not uncommon on a web page to have a banner of some sort and maybe some roundy corners, because the HTML doesn't allow for a way to make a roundy corner. So you make an image for each roundy corner, and then, you know, the lines might be the edges of tables or whatever. But you want the colors in the banner to match perfectly with the colors in the HTML page.
Oh,
now,
okay.
If you use JPEG for a page banner, then the color you see is going to depend on your monitor, because what comes into play is the interaction between the ICC profile in the JPEG and the ICC profile in the monitor. So to display the image so that it looks right, what should happen is that your computer reads the ICC profile out of the JPEG, converts it to PCS, takes the ICC profile of your monitor, and then gives that out to the monitor.
Okay.
However, the actual colors inside HTML are not color space aware. So as you move from monitor to monitor to monitor, the colors in the banner are going to shift relative to the colors in the HTML page.
Okay.
Which means they're not going to blend.
So they choose to do something different to make that work?
So because web developers will insist on using JPEGs, Microsoft, of course, who would never dream of telling anyone they're wrong and just bend to the will of the people, no matter how silly the people are, went, oh, okay, then clearly the answer is to appease these developers, and we're not going to obey color space within our browser. So the upshot is that lazy people can use JPEGs all over the place inappropriately, and their web pages work. The downside is that photographers are left in a mess because all photographs look wrong.
Right.
Apple, being the know-it-alls that they are, have simply gone, no, that's ridiculous. JPEG, the P in JPEG stands for photographer. JPEGs are for photos. We are going to render photos properly. If any web developer is silly enough to use a JPEG for a banner, then they deserve to have their page look wrong. And it makes a lot of people very angry because they have no idea why it's just gone pear-shaped. The answer is they should have used the appropriate format for the appropriate thing. Web graphics should be written in image formats that are designed for the web. The two in particular are GIF and PNG.
Ah.
If you use GIFs and PNGs, you won't have any funny color shifts if you use a color space aware browser.
You know, so your banners, I've always used. You said I can use PNGs or
PNGs,
no?
PNGs. Yeah. PNGs and GIFs are both proper for browser for web graphics.
Where doesn't the P and PNG stand for photograph?
No, portable. Portable network graphics.
So PNG really replaces GIF, but what replaces JPEG? I thought PNGs replaced
nothing. JPEG is JPEG.
Oh.
JPEG is meant for photos. So if it's a photo, you use a JPEG.
Oh.
If it's a web graphic, so a banner or a little roundy corner or a button or anything that you want to be a web graphic, it should be in PNG or GIF. So what Safari rightly does is it treats photos as photos and web graphics as web graphics based on the file type. So that's why when you go to Flickr in Safari, it looks nice. It looks right. And if you go to the same site in IE, it doesn't, or in Firefox.
I see. So he was right. It was the color profile.
It is the color profiles. Now, if you want to minimize the effect, you should use a color profile called sRGB.
Okay, so this is where we got into something interesting, where I found somewhere in Aperture, when they started talking about it, I did a search in the menus for color profile or sRGB, something like that. And it gave me choices of how to preview it and how to export it. And it apparently had chosen something for me.
I think what Aperture does by default...
Proofing profile?
The proofing profile is to look at something in a certain color space, which means that if you're planning on exporting for the web, you should have your proofing profile set to sRGB. But you should also, when you click the export button, your export presets let you embed a color profile. You should always use sRGB and not Adobe RGB.
So it looks like it's defaulting to Adobe.
That's because your camera shot in Adobe. I think by default it just stays with whatever you gave it. As I understand that the Nikons use Adobe RGB.
So is that by, like if I'm on one image and it says Adobe RGB, if I change that to sRGB, when I go to the next image, will it then be, it'll have flipped back to Adobe? Like is it by image by image or is that, am I telling Aperture, always give me sRGB if I choose that as the proofing profile?
The proofing profile is only for displaying, and it will always display going through sRGB, and that's fine, because that means that you'll see the image the way it's going to look when you export to sRGB.
Okay, so if I change it to proofing profile of sRGB, it's going to be that way for every photo, proofing it.
Proofing it. It doesn't affect how it's exported. So you need to. You can set export presets in Aperture and in anything else.
Right.
And there's going to be one called Web or something, and the chances are that that one is already set to sRGB, but I just make my own one. I call it Flickr. And I set it explicitly to sRGB and to a maximum size of 800 pixels. So that way I'm not sending my big images up to Flickr where people can steal them, and I'm converting them to sRGB so they look the least bad as they can in browsers.
Oh, look, it somehow mine is set to sRGB. My 300 by 300 says sRGB.
It's 300 by 300. Okay, well, that's good, because that's appropriate.
Yeah.
But I'm assuming...
Actually,
when
they
you
all of this...
You go bigger.
How big do you do yours?
800.
Oh, okay.
What sometimes do I do 300? 1,000 if I'm feeling generous. 300 is teeny.
Oh.
300 is probably what you use for the show notes.
Yeah, but I don't do show notes through Aperture. I don't know why I created that one. Maybe I should change it. But I just checked every one of the standard presets, and they're all sRGB.
Okay, well, that's good.
So that's good. So I did upload an sRGB to Flickr, and then, the reason it looked bad was because Firefox did not obey that color profile.
Yeah, now sRGB, if you use sRGB instead of Adobe RGB, it's going to be less bad. But nothing beats actually having the browser aware of color spaces. There's just no way around that.
Okay. So what I did was not less bad. I mean, that was the less bad version. You're saying it would have been worse if I'd done it as Adobe whatever
yes.
it was.
Now, if you'd calibrated your monitor, then the sRGB would have been even closer. Because the act of calibrating your monitor is actually using a physical light measuring device to create the actual ICC profile of your monitor. That's actually what you do when you calibrate your monitor. You create the actual ICC profile for your monitor by physically measuring what it puts out.
Hmm.
So that way it displays everything correctly. So there's a color profile in your camera and a color profile in your monitor. Now, if you're just using what Apple shipped you, it's going to be close, but it's not going to be right. So by using a monitor calibration tool, you create the actual 100% correct color profile for your monitor. And if you use that to edit your photos, they will be very correct. And then if you export them to sRGB, they should look pretty much right in web browsers too.
So I don't do a whole lot of fancy pants photography. Every once in a while I get lucky, you know, when there happen to be raindrops on roses. So most of the time I'm doing, you know, snapshots from a party or something like that. So it doesn't matter too much to me. But
well, actually, that's when it does matter, because they're for sharing.
Right.
So if your monitor has a blue tint and you edit them to look like, you know, proper human skin color on your monitor that actually has a blue tint, you're actually making everyone into Oompa Loompas.
But I don't modify the
color.
But
you don't know that because your monitor is, your color profile is off towards the blue. So you're overcompensating by making them too yellow to counteract the fact that your monitor is actually too blue.
But you're making the assumption that I modify my photos for color, which I don't.
Well, I guess. Yeah, okay. So once you start into the point and you actually start to take that white balance slider and move it, if your monitor isn't calibrated, you're probably making things worse.
Okay.
Because you're going to be compensating for whatever way your monitor is wrong.
I guess that's just not worth the cost to me and the time to me to do that.
It's not really that much cost or time.
It was $100 for that thing.
Yeah.
$100.
In the grand scheme of things, that's what, like half a lens? No, a quarter of a lens?
But again, it's down to what's important to you. You know, like I said, I don't usually do much to the photos. Of course, while I'm talking to you, I am modifying the color of a photo. So,
yeah, the other argument people will often say is, but Bart, you know, I may have a calibrated monitor, but my family won't. So what's the point? Well, right? If you're right, then at least the amount of normally the what you would see on, say, your aunt's monitor or whatever is going to be wrong twice. It's going to be wrong by whatever way your monitor is wrong, and you're going to multiply that wrongness by their wrongness. So you get a very wrong photo. Whereas if at least you're right, then the only thing that's wrong is their wrongness. Does that make sense?
No, because two rights don't make a wrong. No, two wrongs don't make a right.
Well, no, because in this case, it's not linear. You can be off in all sorts of directions. So it's a two-dimensional thing. Imagine a plane and you're off into one direction, they're off in another direction. So at least if you're in the middle, you're actually an awful lot better off. And if your monitor's right and you're properly calibrated, then everyone is going to see pretty close to right and it's all going to be fine. It's just that if you're off and they're off, you just have a mess. You're into Oompa Loompa territory or whatever those guys in that new film, what all the blue guys are called. Navi.
The Navi, there you go. The old school answer was the Smurf. With the Oompa Loompas or the Smurfs, now we have to say something altogether new, right?
Yeah.
Well, cool.
So I hope we haven't confused things.
I caught up.
Okay. Because it's kind of head-wrecking in this idea of ICC profiles going through PCS. But if everything has a profile, then you're okay.
Right.
That's really the main thing to remember. And browsers, for reasons of stupidity, all of them apart from Safari, don't. And this is actually a reason that I use Fluid for viewing Flickr. I don't want to use full Safari, but I use a Fluid site-specific browser for Flickr because that means I'm using the Safari engine, which means I get my color-corrected photos.
So why don't you just use Safari again?
Because I don't like Safari. I just want to use it for Flickr, so I just have an SSB for Flickr.
Ah, okay. That's funny. All right. Well, if that is the end of our, are we out of description on that?
I'm just looking at the show notes, and I think I've touched all the important points in the show notes, and we seem to have gotten there in a fairly organized fashion.
In spite of my attempts to derail you.
Yeah, I don't think we did it in order, but I think we got to all the key points.
All right. Well, if the volcano clears up, we may need a spare Belgian for next week. So all Belgians can apply for the position.
I was going to say, I actually have some stuff prepared.
Oh, so you can pre-record.
If, maybe if we pre-record on Wednesday, regardless of volcanoes, we're still golden. We'll have to see. I'm on vacation all week, so I'm very flexible.
I'm in Texas till 10 o'clock at night on Wednesday night.
That's 10 o'clock my night or your night?
10 o'clock my night. So there's no. That's where my
10 o'clock your night would not work so well.
And I would be just a little bit wrecked, having been at a conference all day and flying. That's when my plane lands. So there's no way I could record on Wednesday.
Okay.
So we'll have to noodle this. I wonder if you want to do a solo or.
I'll tell you, we should figure something out when we're not recording, I guess. I'm not sure people care about our personal schedules.
Watching the sausage get made, as it were. All right. Well, in any case, there will be a chit-chat across something next week.
There'll be something.
All right, Bart. We'll talk to you soon.
Yes. And until whenever you hear me again, happy computing.
Well, as always, it's been a blast playing around the live chat room while I do the show. I got to tell you, I had some weird thing happen in GarageBand while I was recording the live show, and if it hadn't been for the groupthink in the chat room, I would not have been able to figure out what the heck went wrong. All of a sudden, my audio had no sound, even though I could see it had done the recording. So anyway, I give great thanks and shout out to the chat room. And I got to tell you, I watched Nightwise do the Nightcast for the first time today, and it was really fun watching him try to juggle what I juggle every week. Of course, he did a great job, but I think he has a greater appreciation for the mental acts required to record and entertain simultaneously. If you'd like to join the live NoSillaCast, just point your browser to podfeet.com/live at 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, also known as GMT-8, on Sunday nights and join in the fun. In the meantime, send any questions you think are too dumb to ask anyone else over to me at allison@podfeet.com and follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.